Hi, this is Bob Scully, and welcome to another edition of The World Show, the Free Markets series. This week, we discuss the Austrian school. No, that's not an establishment where you pay dearly to send your kids for fancy skiing lessons. It's actually an extremely influential school of economic thought, which began in the 19th century, was extremely well respected in the 20th. They were the first, the Austrian economists, to predict the fall of socialist regimes and command economies, and which is now coming back into the forefront with the troubled times that we're living through. Someone like Ron Paul and all those kids at his campaign rallies crying out, end the Fed, have been linked to the Austrian school of thought. And no one is better suited to explain that to us than one of the great specialists in America, Professor Stephen Horwitz. Here he is. Professor Horwitz, we were joking before the interview. I went to school on the Austrian border. That should qualify me to talk about the Austrian school, but actually it doesn't. The Austrian school is something you hear about a lot in the world of economics, but a little bit intricate. Let's start off. What is it?
Well, the Austrian school is a particular school of thought within economics. It's originated in Austria in the 1870s with the work of a guy named Karl Menger, and the tradition really grew and expanded there, particularly in Vienna, and then moved to the United States after World War II for the most part. And the Austrian school essentially is a particular approach to economics that focuses, unlike much of economics, which sort of thinks about the economy as a machine and tries to apply the methods of the sort of natural sciences to it, the Austrians have always sort of been more based in the humanities and thought about the way in which how people perceive the world and the way and the choices that they make as a result of their perceptions play out and organize themselves together. And so the Austrian school tends to focus on, again, people's choices, their perceptions, and the way in which as individuals try to achieve their plans within an economy, what's the role that, say, prices and markets and the other institutions of the economy play in enabling them to coordinate that behavior with each other? How do suppliers meet demanders and so forth? Again, instead of building sort of mathematical models, we're interested in the way people understand the world.
And there's something sort of existentialist about it, too. They admit that you can't know what the other guy's going to do,
right,
nor should you care, really. Just think about what you're going to do, and then you can't even measure the aggregate of that to predict what a group is going to do.
That's right.
And that's all very modern and liberating in a way, but then again, from a policy perspective, it leaves you sort of speechless. What do you do?
Yeah, I think that's a concern that people often have. And I think two things. One, it's not that Austrians say we can't sort of know or predict the results of particular policies. It's just as Friedrich Hayek said, we can only make pattern predictions. We can say that if the price of a good goes up, the quantity demanded will fall. We can say if we impose a price control on a good that we'll get shortages. We just can't predict exactly how much and exactly, you know, as if we were predicting the movement of planets or something like that. So we can still say these things about policy because we know that people react in predictable kinds of ways to certain sorts of events in the economy. And we know that you know, if you try to prevent prices from moving to their market clearing levels, it will mess up people's ability to figure out what people want and how to produce it most efficiently. So again, we can say things and we can make these sort of broad predictions about how people will coordinate their actions and how often government policies can distort them. We just can't be as precise as saying it will be some, you know, particular mathematical amount.
And when you name Hayek, of course, some viewers will say, oh, yes, Road to Serfdom, because that book has enjoyed a renaissance in the past few years and is, of course, an indictment of totalitarianism and particularly socialist totalitarianism. Yeah. What I was even more impressed by is Mises, the other famous Austrian of the 20th century. He predicted the fall of Soviet communism 3 years after the Bolshevik Revolution.
That's right.
That's incredible. And so he must have been laughed out of town when he did that.
I think, you know, both Mises and Hayek, I mean, Mises in 1920 argued that attempting to completely plan an economy by abolishing markets was doomed to fail. And so you're quite right. He said this what was happening in Soviet Russia at the time couldn't sustain itself. And later on in the 30s and 40s, Hayek was engaged in the extension of that debate, making very similar arguments. And I think they were both laughed at. And Hayek, I think, once said close to his, you know, when he was in his later years after the fall of the wall, he said, I'm one of the few people whose theories were thought to be wrong, and I lived long enough to see them be proven right.
Yeah.
So both Mises and Hayek, Mises unfortunately didn't live long enough to see it, but in the end, their arguments about the inability of socialist planners to make an economy grow and to satisfy people's wants were both demonstrated to be correct with the collapse, at least, of full-fledged socialism around the world. course, we still see it in smaller ways and bits and pieces. And I'm not sure the lessons mm-hmm. of their argument have really been digested fully, but certainly no one these days is calling for sort of full and complete economic planning in the way.
No, of course not. No, that idea is, I think they pretty much put the nail yeah. into the coffin, and so did That's reality,
right.
of course.
That's right.
Since all these regimes are collapsing. And I think they'd have fun with China.
Yeah, looking it's an at interesting it case. Yeah.
Now, however, that they can find the flaw in planning and demonstrate it brilliantly is now, I think, a pretty much an admitted fact. Yeah. But what about what you're supposed to do? That's not so clear.
Yeah,
if you're an Austrian, what would an Austrian do tomorrow in the U.S. Treasury?
Yeah, I mean, right.
What would he do?
Well, I think the question, the way Austrians would approach that question is to understand that the question of what do we do is not always, is usually not a question of what do politicians do or what do bureaucrats do, but how do we get them out of the way so that individuals can do what they do best, so that entrepreneurs mm-hmm. can do what they do best. And so in general, Austrians tend to call for finding ways for government to stick to its constitutional limits, for it to create a stable framework within which that entrepreneurs can plan for the future and try to use the price system to figure out what it is that consumers want and best provide it for them, and that consumers know with confidence too that when they go into the market, that's that same stable framework will be in place. So one of the things Austrians would recommend, certainly when we think about policy in the broad sense, is that stopping the kind of discretionary moving back and forth and always changing plans from sort of one week to another kind of thing we've seen particularly in the U.S. government, I'd say, yeah. in the last 5 or 10 years.
And so when we hit Ron Paul, does he qualify in your eyes as an Austrian?
I think it's fair enough to call. He's certainly strongly influenced by the Austrian school.
So when you hear the crowd say, end the Fed, end the Fed, end the Fed, and then you read an Austrian theory, suddenly the light goes on and you say, aha. But if you ended the Fed and you did not have, the Austrians say that when a tool for economic exchange is needed, it springs up spontaneously. Yeah. Well, that's money.
Right.
If you didn't have the Fed, how would you have money?
Well, simply in the United States before 1913, 1914, we had no central bank, and mm-hmm. we had perfectly, you know, it had problems, but we had money. We had a monetary system that generally worked pretty well. It had its own problems, and I think those problems were due to some of the other kinds of government interventions there. But one of
it was issued by states and banks.
It was issued by private banks, but under significant regulation that made it difficult for them sometimes to respond to consumer demand like with any other market. And so we had these periodic panics in the U.S. Canada, by contrast, but it's worth noting, had no central bank until 1934 mm-hmm. and was remarkably free of all of these problems. So we have other historical evidence too that systems without central banks work just fine. And we know from the history of money that money itself grew not from kings declaring something money or somebody inventing money, but through an evolutionary process that grew from barter into indirect exchange and gave us the things that we call money. And we see money evolve when people use cigarettes in concentration camps or other kinds of things.
Yeah, sure, for barter. But that's always on a smaller scale. Yeah. And I don't want to let one opportunity pass to say that for our friends in the U.S. who know Molson's for beer, they might want to know that there were Molson's banknotes at some point, because it was a Molson's bank. Probably exchangeable for beer too.
Could have been. Beer standard might be more stable than what we've got today.
But if you try to, money now has become so fungible and it is so rapidly traded by computers, it's hard to imagine that you could do without a quote-unquote informal world currency, which the U.S. dollar is.
Yeah.
You know, all these, if you went back to a jumble of things issued for very good reasons by people who want to issue it, how in the world would you ever put the jigsaw
puzzle? Well, I think a couple of things. One, it's, you know, those currencies would be redeemable in some commodity. It might be gold, but necessarily not. And that gives you a sort of unifying link between all of those. And the fact is, we have the dollar, we have the euro, we have the yen, we have multiple currencies floating around the world right now. And that very same computer technology makes it pretty easy for us to exchange those to deal with the exchange rates between those different currencies. I often travel between the U.S. and Canada and carry both currencies with me, and there's no problem. Even when they're not at par, there's no problem exchanging them. So I think we have ways of overcoming those. And the real question is, are the costs of dealing with multiple currency less than the cost of having a single monopoly currency that's subject to inflation and devaluation in the way that we've seen? And I think my argument would be the cost that we would bear from dealing with multiple currencies would be much less than having a single monopoly provider.
In other words, the Fed, the slogan came up because some people are fed up, no pun intended, with it being ever so much less. It never grows in value, it just inflates and then...
And then devalues, and I think part of why we're seeing it now is a perception, and I think a correct one according to Austrian theories of the business cycle, that the Fed was significantly responsible for generating the housing boom in the U.S. that has now turned into the recession that we can't seem to recover from. And the cheap credit we saw, say, you know, from 2002 to 2006, generated by the Fed, made it possible for people to take out all these housing loans that eventually turned into the bust. I think there's other factors involved there too. But Austrian business cycle theory, going back to the, you know, over 100 years, has always said that inflation generates an unsustainable boom that will eventually turn into a bust. And I think we've seen a textbook example of that in the last decade.
And so the Fed's printing press is really, in a sense, too powerful.
That's right.
To be left in the hands of the Fed.
That's right. I mean, you know, we generally, not just Austrians, but economists in general, and I think most of the public, are skeptical of monopolies. We know that, you know, monopolies don't serve the consumer very well. You know, think of the post office or, you know, whatever one you might want to pick on. But yet we give the most important good in our economy, money, turn it over to a monopoly provider, especially when, we have all this historical evidence in various places that competitive money production worked just fine when governments didn't step in and try to take it over for their own purposes.
And gold backing, is, as you say, it's not the only possible backing, but it has a discipline inherent to it. That was a source of ridicule a few years ago, less as time goes by. Well, how close are we to a gold standard?
Well, I don't know how close we are, but I think what's true in the last few years, and I've been studying central banking and the Fed, my own research, for 25 years, the questions that we're discussing right now have never, ever been in play in the public domain in the way they have been in the last few years. There's never been serious talk of a gold standard in the way you hear it sometimes today. And so I think that's a huge step forward. Whether, in fact, we're going to get to one, how close we are in reality to getting to one, I'm not optimistic. But the fact that we're talking about it, I think, demonstrates a recognition, and one that Ron Paul has sort of, you know, grabbed a hold of.
Popularized.
Yeah, that the Fed is a big source of economic trouble. And the Austrians, for a long time, have been arguing that central banks in general the analogy I sometimes use is they turn all the traffic lights green, right? And when all the lights are green, cars are going to crash into each other. And expansionary credit from the central bank, that's what it ends up doing. It turns those interest rate traffic signals green and leads to lots of car wrecks. And we've certainly saw a big one in the last few years.
And are the Austrians traditionalists with this? Because when people hear about the gold standard, they think, okay, redeemable, you know, you could take that little piece of paper and go to the government and they'd give you a gold coin for it. There's also a kind of a tricky variant on that is, let's peg a currency to the price of gold.
Yeah.
What do you think of that?
No, I think that's the first one. I think when Austrians are talking about a gold standard or a commodity standard of any kind, it's, and normally for the Austrians, it's not just central bank saying your Federal Reserve note's redeemable in gold, but again, this sort of competitive money production where different multiple banks are offering different currencies, all of which are redeemable in gold or perhaps in silver. And again, historically we've seen this, and when you don't, when the government doesn't mess around with it in other ways, it works quite well. Before the central bank in the United States, before the Fed, we never had the levels of inflation that we've seen. We did not have the business cycles that we've seen. We had other problems, but nothing on the scale of what we've seen since 1913.
And you mentioned monopolies are we now know, of course, are not very, as you say, friendly to the consumer. And yet, Austrians don't like antitrust laws, which in the popular imagination are precisely a remedy against monopolies, going back to trust busting with the railroads and oil. Why don't Austrians like antitrust?
Well, I think there's two reasons, one theoretical, one historical, and I'll take the historical first. I think if you look at the origins of the antitrust laws, what you find is many of them were actually supported by the same big businesses that they're supposed to regulate, because the big businesses saw those laws as a way that they could oftentimes protect themselves from smaller competitors. It was the larger railroads who wanted the antitrust laws because they saw in the smaller railroads were often adopting competitive strategies that were winning, that were outdoing the large railroads and keeping prices so low, people would talk of ruinous competition. And so the idea behind the antitrust laws was often a way for those larger firms to gain leverage of power. Even today, the vast majority of antitrust suits are brought not by the government, but by another firm who's lost out in the competitive marketplace. So Austrians worry that, in fact, what antitrust laws often do is to protect competitors, not competition, that is, to protect the particular firms. The theoretical story, Austrians view competition as a discovery procedure. We just don't know what the right number of firms is, what the right size of firms is. The whole reason we need competition is to find out. The same reason we have athletic competition, we have the World Series or the Stanley Cup Final, is to figure out which team's better. If we knew, we wouldn't bother playing. And so for Austrians, we have to let that competitive process unfold. Sometimes that means one firm will have a significant foothold, but as long as the market has no legal barriers to entry, there's always opportunities for other firms to either come into that market or develop a technological substitute, the same way cell phones have sort of moved around the old wired phone service. So for Austrians, we just don't know what the right look for the market is. And the way we learn that is through the competitive process. And antitrust law often goes to break up monopolies that are serving people well, at least for the time being. Just the challenge I often pose to people is to name an example in U.S. history of a monopoly, of a firm who gained a monopoly without the help of the government, and when they got it, raised their prices and dropped their level of output. I don't believe there is such an example.
But without going to the Marxist view, which is really the polar opposite, that capitalism must lead to monopoly, without adopting that, it's not impossible to think that if you have a pure regulation-free market, a company might end up gobbling up every other company. Is that totally...
I mean, they could gobble up some, but go back to our earlier conversation about the problems with socialist planning. If a firm gets large enough, it begins to face those same problems too. And we've certainly seen some examples in the last 10 or 20 years of firms that tried to grow too big too quickly. Mm-hmm. AOL buying Time Warner, for example, looked like a great idea at the time, turned out to be a disaster. So, and we see firms moving and out. The sort of mobility in the largest 100 or 500 firms is much more than people think it is. For example, a company called Walmart didn't even exist in that top, 25 years ago, and Google and all these sorts of firms have moved up. So I'm not concerned about that sort of what economists sometimes call concentration. I think as long as the market is competitive and consumers can vote with their dollars, firms, even large firms who gain a significant market share, who can't please people, will find themselves losing out to firms that do.
And does the Austrian, because again, people who've heard of Ron Paul, now, so it's automatic when you open that drawer, a whole bunch of things come out. There's these economic theories that we've just discussed. Does that go with, for instance, less military involvement of America abroad, or has nothing to do with it?
I wouldn't say it has nothing to do with it. I think if you take the Austrian view seriously, that it's very hard for human beings to intentionally design markets, intentionally design societies, because the degree of knowledge that we can centralize in one place is not very much, and that we need institutions that enable us to take advantage of people's knowledge. Somehow the idea that the United States can go abroad and rebuild a country, right, and can just somehow go in there and bring democracy at the point of a gun, falls victim to that same criticism. If we can't create and plan our own economic institutions, why would anyone think we can do it in countries with different cultures who we know nothing about? So at least in that sense, I think there's a caution within the Austrian school about our ability to not just plan our own economy the way Austrians argued against socialism, but to think we have the intelligence and the sort of, the ability to go into other countries and tell them how to take care of their business. So to that extent, I think it does follow from the Austrian school. But again, I think those are distinct positions.
And so let's say if we had an ideal Austrian type party in power at some point, we know we wouldn't have the Fed. We would have, by and large, a smaller government. Department of Commerce would be smaller. The Trade Commission would be smaller, all of that.
Smaller, perhaps down to zero.
Okay. And that might please a lot of people listening to us. But how about the social services that are provided by government, hospitals, universities, in some cases, sometimes privately, sometimes publicly? Would the public sector in that area go away?
Well, I think one of the things you have to do, we live in a world where government does all of these things already. So I think two important considerations. One is that, government has made promises to people, people have built their retirement around Social Security and things like that. So you can't just yank that out from people. But I think there's two things you can do, one of which is you can open those up to competition, something like the public schools, right? Let's make it easier for private schools to compete with the public schools through vouchers or tax credits or some program like that as a means toward eventually seeing whether people vote with their feet. Mm-hmm. I think in the case of social services, we, again, have to keep the promises we've made to people. But giving people the option, young people in particular, the option of getting out of, say, Social Security and investing those funds privately is the way to
go. Like IRAs and KEOs.
Yeah, right. And what we want, we're raising a generation of sort of the under 40 generation who's just grown up expecting there always to be choice and competition. They've grown up in the world of the internet where they can pretty much do and find information the way they want. They want to be able to manage their own lives. And I think from just as Austrian, the way Austrians think about the notion of competition again is having those multiple options on the table and letting people decide how they want to invest their funds, how they see the relevant ways to plan for their retirement, or, you know, that should be their option. I think you say the same thing about education. When we think about, you know, welfare for the needy, that becomes a little bit more tricky. There are certainly some influenced by the Austrians who are fine with a sort of basic, you know, sort of minimal income level. I think many of the social services that government now provides, they don't do very well.
So guaranteed income, but you could use that money to buy what you
want.
Right,
that's right. And we think about various welfare programs, okay? I mean, we've been doing this, certainly in the United States now, since on a serious scale for 45 years. Have we solved the problem? No. In fact, in some ways, it might be worse than it ever was. And one of the reasons is that government welfare provision has crowded out the sort of decentralized ways in which private actors were able to provide it, both through the marketplace, but more importantly, through civil society, through churches and synagogues and mosques and friendly societies and all these sorts of things, which have just lost those functions as the state has come in and taken them over. And again, I think, as we move away from government provision, we ought to see those forms filling back in.
And we have certainly seen there's no shortage of socialist regimes that have collapsed, sometimes on a very big scale. Are there contrary examples that you like of governments or countries that have gone in the right, let's say, an Austrian direction?
Yeah, since the recession and crisis, it's hard because everyone, I think, has gone in the opposite direction. But a couple sort of, smaller scale success stories. I think what the Canadian government has done in the last decade plus has been in the right direction. They've managed to cut at the federal level, cut the size of government. They weathered the crisis much better than the U.S. did, I think, for a variety of reasons. They've managed to keep themselves out of the large debt problem the U.S. faces. I think we're seeing interesting things happening right now in Sweden. They have, surprisingly, we think of the Scandinavian countries as being just the opposite, but they've done some budget cutting. And the Swedish, while the welfare state remains significant, their regulation of economic activity, of new businesses and things like that, is actually quite low. And so we've seen a success story there. Some of the Baltic countries, Estonia is one that people have been pointing to in recent months. So I do think there are some success stories out there. It's where governments have had the ability to make those cuts. I think, again, the Canadian example is interesting because they did it before the crisis and set themselves up in a much better way. And they did not go on the spending binge that the U.S. went on in the last, decade.
And when an Austrian looks at the present crisis, Austrians already have an eye for chaos, I've noticed, an entropy, sort of, because everybody cannot, by definition, know what the other fellow's thinking and so on. When they look at that, does the Austrian head for the hills with a supply of gold, cans of food, a rifle, and bottles of water?
There's a few. I don't think you do. I mean, I'm a short-run cynic and a long-run optimist. So I tend to think things are going to get worse in the short run, but eventually get better in the long run. Couple of things. I think the one thing I would say about this current crisis is I think this has set us back in a certain sort of way. I still think my kids and my grandchildren will live much better lives than I do. They'll be
American households lost 40% of their equity.
They did. So I do think that in that sense, right, my kids will live a better life and my grandkids will live a better life. I mean, the world's a magical place. What's true, though, is they won't live as better a life as they might have before the boom and then the bust. And then, I mean, I think you have to separate out the boom and bust itself, which caused damage, as you point out. And then the policies we've enacted since the recession, which at least in the United States have made matters much worse by running up the debt, by further regulating business, we're in a recovery that by historical standards is unbelievably weak and long and slow, and the recovery in employment in particular. And I think you can point, that's not inherent in markets recovering. That is a result of mistaken policies that we've adopted both by Bush and Obama administrations. So I'm cynical about those effects of those short-run policies, but I think human beings are smart and creative and inventive, and we all want to live better lives. And while we have all these terrible things going on with economic policies, we're saving lives in new ways like we never have before. The cost of electronics and food over the long run have become significantly cheaper. People spend less of their income on clothing, on food, and shelter than they did before. We are fabulously rich compared to 50 or 100 years ago. We're not going to be quite as rich as we could have been if we hadn't made the mistakes we've made.
And final question, that loss, that precipitous drop in the equity of households, prudent people used to know, well, there's risk in the stock market, there's risk in money because of inflation, but real estate is great. And now the real estate is what has sunk them. What's left? Gold? Should people, should people listening to us, where should they protect their wealth?
I think it's always good to have a diversified portfolio, no matter what the situation is. If you're going to throw all your money, all your wealth in gold, I think that's a mistake. I think, you know, real estate's not going to come back on fire anytime soon. But there's all kinds of ways. I'm no investment guru, but it seems to me it's always prudent to diversify your portfolio. How much of you put in various things at any particular time, you know, I think now I would be trying to protect myself against the long run potential for inflation and for you know, problems associated with the debt. But even there, you don't want to put everything all in one place, whether it's gold or run off to the hill with the canned food in the water. I'm not headed in that direction.
Well, anyway, Professor Horowitz, you've gone around and turned off some of those green lights. Maybe there were too many of them.
Yeah, I hope
and
so.
And a few red and yellow wouldn't hurt. So thank you so much. Long life and good luck.
Thank you for having me.
Professor Stephen Horowitz was our guest this week on the Free Markets series of the World Show. I'm Bob Scully. Have a great week. Thanks.